Dr. Nesbitt, Dr. Francis, members and guests. We live in the midst of a global surge in obesity that has been attributed primarily, if not solely, to a toxic environment with unending overnutrition and increasingly sedentary occupations and immobilizing technologies, decreasing activity. Not surprisingly, given this concept, the treatment of obesity has focused on dietary and behavioral therapy and increasing obesity. Last year at this meeting, I talked about the genetic neurobiologic contribution to obesity and its implications for the failure of dietary and behavioral therapy to achieve weight loss maintenance. Today, I want to address the issue of and challenge of decreased activity in obesity and its implications for hypertension. So I will address three issues: spontaneous physical activity in obesity, the concept of molecular regulation or influences on activity, and finally, the role of exercise training. So let's begin with a brief distinction between spontaneous physical activity and exercise activity. The spontaneous physical activity has as synonyms the activities of daily living, habitual physical activity, non-volitional physical activity, and its metabolic counterpart, non-exercise activity, thermogenesis, or NEAT. This contrasts with exercise activity, which is purposeful physical activity undertaken for health or bodily exertion to develop and maintain fitness. And these distinctions have implications for our discussion. So let me begin with this study from Levine at the Mayo Clinic on variation in spontaneous physical activity or activities of daily living in obesity. They studied 10 lean sedentary volunteers and 10 age-matched obese sedentary volunteers, and found that although time spent in the supine position did not differ, the obese individuals spent 2 hours more per day sitting and correspondingly 2 hours less per day standing or an ambulating, that is 2 hours less per day in activities of daily living. This difference has profound consequences and accounts for about 350 calories per day difference in these two groups. Now, what is the significance of this difference in weight gain? And to address that, I want to digress just a minute to remind you that although the environment contributes greatly to the surge in obesity, there are individuals who are genetically prone to develop obesity in a toxic environment and individuals who are genetically resistant to obesity in a toxic environment, just as there are salt-sensitive and salt-resistant individuals in our environment. So what is the contribution of spontaneous physical activity in this difference to that concept? Well, first of all, let me just document for you the variability in fat gain during overfeeding in lean humans, again from Levine's group. They fed 16 non-obese young adult volunteers, overfed them by 1,000 kilocalories per day for 8 weeks. Fat gain in these individuals varied tenfold, from 0.4 to 4.2 kilograms, supporting the concept I just mentioned of obesity-prone and obesity-resistant individuals. And twin studies by Bouchard and his colleagues have demonstrated that a substantial portion of this variability in fat gain during overfeeding is genetically determined. So the question is, what is the contribution of spontaneous physical activity to this variability. And that brings us to Levine's concept of non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is the metabolic equivalent, if you will, of variations in spontaneous physical activities of daily living. It contributes substantially to metabolic regulation. And in their study, they found that it contributed importantly to the variability in fat gain during controlled overfeeding in humans. Let me explain. So those individuals that increased non-exercise activity thermogenesis, not talking about sports or exercise, we're talking about activities of daily living, during controlled overfeeding had the lowest weight gain. Those individuals who did not increase spontaneous activity had the highest weight gain. There was, in contrast, there was no correlation of fat gain with BMR. So these studies suggest that variations in spontaneous physical activity and their metabolic equivalent, NEAT, contribute importantly to variations in weight gain during controlled overfeeding. Now, there is evidence to suggest that this phenomenon of spontaneous physical activity is biologically determined and perhaps genetically and familial determined. This is from the Quebec family study, 1,600 subjects, 3-day activity records, and they found that genetic factors accounted for 20 to 29% of the variation in spontaneous physical activity. The highest genetic variance was for the inactive phenotype. Ravison and Bacardis and their colleagues have found the same phenomenon in the Pima Indians, who have a high prevalence of obesity. They found that spontaneous physical activity accounted for average of 13% of total energy expenditure, and that it was a familial trait, with 57% of the variance in spontaneous physical activity being familial and independent of body fat and weight. Now, you might say you're skeptical of these observations, that the first study was based on a survey, second study here, Pima Indians, who have a very high prevalence of profound obesity. But let me show you an experimental study. There are rats, inbred strains of rats, that are either genetically prone or genetically resistant to obesity in a high-fat diet. And what this slide shows from Kotz's work in Minneapolis is that even before they were fed the high-fat diet, even while they were still lean, the rats that were genetically prone to obesity had lower activity than those that were genetically resistant. So there appears to be a familial and possibly genetic contribution to spontaneous physical activity, both in experimental animals and in humans. So this brings me back to the study I showed you initially by Levine, showing that obese individuals spent 2 hours less per day in spontaneous physical activity, activities of daily living. What I didn't tell you when I showed you this first slide is that they did something, if you pardon the pun, neat in this study. And that is, they had the lean individuals gain weight and the obese individuals lose weight, and they repeated the measurements. And they found that these differences were not changed when the obese lost weight or the lean gained weight. There are two possible explanations for that finding. The first is that this difference is a learned or conditioned behavior, so that when the stimulus disappears, particularly briefly, the difference in the activity remains. The other possible explanation that attracted our attention is that this difference is biologically and perhaps genetically determined. That is, that there are some individuals who are biologically and perhaps genetically prone to decreases in spontaneous physical activity or activities of daily living. So when I went to the Rockefeller and began to work with Jeff Friedman 4 years ago, I suggested that we pursue studies on what I would say, in the broadest sense of the word, is the molecular regulation of activity, focusing the initial studies on the role of leptin in the regulation of activity. Studies pursued with two talented postdocs, Giovanni Saccarini from Friedman Lab and Anna Rabel from the PATH Lab. So as you know, leptin is a hormone released, secreted from white adipose tissue, circulates, enters the brain by crossing the blood-brain barrier to decrease food intake, increase thermogenesis, and thereby decrease adiposity. Although the interest in leptin has focused on these responses, it is a very pleiotropic hormone with effects on reproductive function, immune function, and as you may know, sympathetic regulation of blood pressure. So we postulated that leptin might also contribute to the regulation of activity. And so we studied the OBOB leptin deficient mice that have a mutation in a single gene, loss of function mutation in the leptin gene, and are completely leptin deficient with severe early onset, severe obesity. Now this slide shows that the OBOB leptin deficient mice have reduced activity. They have profound decreases in both running wheel activity and home cage activity in both males and females. Now the conventional explanation for this is that it's secondary, the decreased activity is secondary to the obesity. These are the ultimate couch potatoes. So what we did was we treated them with physiologic doses of leptin to increase leptin levels from zero to physiologic levels. And we found that whereas with vehicle, there was no increase in activity. In fact, with time, there was a tendency for a decrease in activity. Whereas with physiologic leptin reconstitution, there was an increase in activity. So once again, the conventional explanation for this is that this increase in activity is simply related to their weight loss. So we made measurements during the very early stages of leptin treatment and found, as shown here in this slide, showing increases in activity from control and decreases in body weight from control, that leptin produced a substantial early increases in activity in the second, fourth day at a time when there was no substantial decrease in weight loss. And we've seen the same thing with cerebroventricular administration of leptin, indicating that these changes in activity are both centrally, neurally mediated and can occur independent of decreases in body weight. With prolonged treatment and decreases in body weight, there were further increases in activity, but these early increases in activity cannot be explained by decreases in adiposity. So these studies demonstrate that leptin-deficient OB mice are profoundly hypoactive, and the leptin reconstitution in OB mice produces a rapid increase in activity before weight loss. Now, there's a critical experiment in a study like this. Leptin does two things. First of all, it increases leptin levels. It also decreases food intake. So in order to conclude that a response, such as the increase in activity, is due to a direct effect of leptin, one has to exclude the possibility that the response was simply due to the decrease in food intake and had nothing specifically to do with leptin. To test that, one performs studies called pair feeding. And this slide shows the results of the pair feeding experiments. In this protocol, as I showed you before, one gives leptin, and here we observe the increase in activity. So then to determine whether this increase in activity is related to a direct effect of leptin or to simply to the decrease in food intake, we perform studies in a control group not treated with leptin, but whose food intake was decreased to that of the leptin-treated group. And surprisingly, we saw, if anything, even a greater increase in activity. This was not a happy day in the laboratory because it suggested that this response might simply be due to a decrease in food intake. Until we saw these results from those experiments, which show the temporal pattern of the increase in activity with leptin and with pair feeding. This is the light phase when mice are typically not active, and the dark phase when they are. One sees that with leptin treatment, the increase in activity occurred entirely during the dark phase, whereas with the pair feeding, the pattern, temporal pattern of the increase in activity was very different from that seen during leptin, with increases in activity starting to occur well before the dark phase and peaking early in the dark phase. This suggests what is known as food seeking or food anticipatory activity, in contrast to what we might call total locomotor activity. So to test this, we performed experiments using what is known as a food anticipatory activity protocol. So this is the light phase, this is the dark phase, blue indicates when food is available. With this protocol, we begin to restrict the time when food is available to ultimately 4 hours here at the start of the dark phase. Here we even move the food availability into the light phase, and the mice during this food restriction protocol begin to anticipate, and the availability of the restricted amounts of food, and they start to increase their activity well before the availability of food, so that you see food anticipatory activity. So this slide shows that leptin produces opposing effects on food anticipatory activity and total activity. This activity here is the activity in the 3 hours before the availability of restricted food divided by total 24-hour activity. And what you see is that the leptin-deficient OB mice have a profound increase, a robust increase in food anticipatory activity. They spend 40 to 60% of their total 24-hour activity in the 3 hours, moving in the 3 hours before the availability of food. Leptin completely abolishes this food anticipatory or food seeking behavior. In contrast, in the same protocol, the total leptin increase the total 24-hour locomotor activity. So these studies demonstrate that leptin in physiologic levels, and I should tell you that when we gave pharmacologic or superphysiologic levels in the OB mice, we did not see further increases in activity. So leptin in physiologic levels abolishes food anticipatory activity and increases total locomotor activity in OB mice independent of changes in body weight. Now, do these observations pertain in humans? Well, you probably know there are rare Mendelian human counterparts of the OB mice in children with loss of function mutations in the leptin gene and complete leptin deficiency who have profound early onset obesity at a very early age with very aggressive food-seeking activity and profound decreases in physical activity and locomotor activity. Treatment with leptin, as shown in this child, normalizes the obesity without interfering with growth and lean body mass. So, what is the correlation of our observations in the OB mice with the effects of leptin in these children? Well, this is from Sadaf Farooqi and Stephen O'Reilly's studies, and one of these children who at age 4 had profound obesity, weighed 90 pounds. They decided to test appetite, food-seeking behavior, so they put a test meal in front of the child in the morning with normal 24-hour adult calorie intake. The child ate all of it. In fact, they said in retrospect, they'd put more food in front of the child would have eaten that. Then they began treatment with leptin, and within several weeks, put another test meal in front of the child. Child ate 180 kilocalories, a tenfold reduction in calorie intake, consistent with the concept that leptin suppresses food-seeking, food anticipatory activity, and that appetite is a very biologically controlled variable. What about physical activity, spontaneous activity? We corresponded with Sadaf Farooqi, and she said, we have indeed repeatedly seen a very early increase in physical activity with leptin treatment before the patients lose weight. The patients walk more quickly, they move more frequently, and are generally just more lively with leptin. So these studies indicate that these observations pertain in humans with leptin deficiency. This study highlights the concept of molecular regulation and influences of activity as well as appetite. Now, in my closing comments, I want to just address very briefly not spontaneous physical activity, activities of daily living, but the role of exercise and exercise training in hypertension and obesity, just very briefly. So this is a study from the investigators at the Baker Institute have done an elegant series of experiments showing the effects of 4 weeks of exercise training in hypertensive subjects, with three experimental periods, sedentary, 45 minutes of cycling at 60 to 70% max, 3 times a week or 7 times a week. Now, this isn't the most intense exercise training, but it's also not a leisurely walk in Central Park. So in these studies, they found decreases in both systolic and diastolic blood pressure that were slightly greater when the exercise was performed 7 times a week. These studies were accompanied by decreases in plasma norepinephrine and particularly renal sympathetic nerve activity, suggesting that they were, at least in parts, mediated by sympathetic inhibition. And the good news is that the blood pressure decreases began within 1 week and plateaued after 2 weeks. The bad news is that with detraining, blood pressure and norepinephrine began to rise within 2 weeks. So let's look at the obesity, the exercise training obesity, from James Hill and Holly Wyatt in Colorado. They have concluded there's an inverse relationship between physical activity and weight gain. Interestingly, provocatively, they suggest that exercise does not appear to contribute to weight loss, but as you may know, it is critical for the maintenance of weight loss because it prevents the decreases in metabolism that accompany dietary therapy. So, as you may know, 90% of people who lose weight by dietary and behavioral therapy regain it within 3 to 5 years. But there is a small percentage, maybe 10% of individuals, who maintain weight loss maintenance, maintain weight loss. And Rena Wing, Brown and Hill have a national weight control registry, a voluntary registry. Individuals who succeeded in long-term weight loss, and they've been characterizing this, they found that the primary strategy in 90% of these individuals is frequent long periods of moderately high intensity physical exercise, equivalent to 60 minutes per day of moderately high intensity exercise. So you say, well, fine, we'll just train people who are on dietary and behavioral therapy to exercise 60 minutes a day, moderate high physical levels. So that's what they tried to do. They did a nice study, a randomized controlled trial of high physical activity, 202 subjects randomly assigned to standard behavioral therapy or standard behavioral therapy with high physical activity. At 18 months, when they were in the support groups, trainers, a support group, the high physical activity group had higher physical activity and weight loss, but when they stopped the support groups, the high physical activity group did not sustain physical activity, and at 30 months, there was no difference in activity levels or weight loss. The interpretation, there is relapse from adherence to high physical activity, just as there is relapse from adherence to dietary therapy. And let me just tell you that, although I've not shown here for the interest of time, there are controlled randomized studies where primary physicians have given either no recommendations or recommendations, advice, and prescriptions on lower levels of activity to individuals who were not previously active. The benefits are short-lived and small. So I conclude, perhaps provocatively, that although exercise is effective in lowering blood pressure and in promoting weight maintenance, compliance is the challenge. It is highest among the educated, affluent, young, and motivated. And thus I predicted to suggest that exercise training is not likely to have widespread applicability in the prevention of obesity, and a greater focus should be given to involuntary programs that increase activities of daily living in the workplace, schools, and public places. Increase spontaneous physical activity that is non-volitional. Thank you very much.